don't know if you had the time to see the video, but so there was the imaginary something like a squirrel that is in space, moving in space, and the video shows how it falls down. But then the some questions arise, and that would be that it is fine to say that for an object flying past a massive object, the space-time is curved by a massive object, and so the object flying past flows the curved path of a geodesic, so it appears to be experimental, experiencing gravitational acceleration. Do we also say along with it that the object falling past in reality experiences no attraction force towards the massive object? Is it like following the space-time geodesic curve while experiencing no attractive force? And also, if we're talking about objects that do not move, so the issue is, supposing two objects are at rest relative to each other, they are not following any space-time geodesic, then why will they experience gravitational attraction towards each other? Example, why will an apple fall to Earth? Why won't it be seated there in its original position high above the Earth? How does the curvature of space-time cause it to experience an attraction force towards the Earth? And why would we need to exert a force in the reverse direction to prevent it from falling? How does the curvature of the space-time cause it?
Objects exist in a gradient of a temporal gradient. The top of the apple is experiencing time a little bit faster than the bottom of the apple. And so there are forces afoot. Again, you have something called four momentum, which is the velocities and time. So if you're going to have an object that's going to experience a gradient in which a part of it is going through time at a slower rate, it has to make up that momentum by going faster in a velocity in some vector, usually pointing directly at the space-time disturbance that's producing the temporal dilation. So gravity is the pseudo force we feel of an object attempting to right its momentum according to time dilation. And that's it. I mean, it's not simple, unfortunately, but that's what relativity tells us.
Interesting. So I'm going to repeat what you said, trying to see if that what I say is in agreement with what you say. So even the object at rest in the given reference time frame are actually moving through space-time, because the space-time is not just the space, but also the time apple is getting older, moving through time. The velocity through space-time is called a four velocity, and it is always equal to the speed of light. So the space-time in the gravitational field is curved, so the time axis, well, in simple terms, is no longer orthogonal to the space axis. So the apple moving first only in time direction starts accelerating in space thanks to the curvature of, well, the mixture of the space and time axis. So the velocity in time becomes a velocity in space. Do I say it right?
Yeah, the word you were searching is orthogonal. It's not really for velocity, it's for momentum, because the mass is a factor as well as the velocity vector and the time vector.
Yeah, so the acceleration happened because the time flows slower than the gravitational potential is decreasing. So Apple is moving deeper into the gravitational field. Thus, the velocity in time direction is changing as time gets slower and slower.
Yes.
Okay. So, talking about that unfortunate guy who killed himself in the Tesla Cybertruck, I don't see, although I should respect the revelation about his testimony or his letter left in media, I would say there is no evidence that as he said, because I have the whole of that letter in front of me, that manifesto, that those drones were coming from the submarine and Chinese origin to the coast, flying over New Jersey, and they were, he used the frame, not anti-gravity, but he used the phrase gravity control propulsion. Well, there was so many things government did in gravity propulsion. So many millions of dollars were spent for nothing. Just to wait.
Well, number one, crazy people say crazy things. Number two, governments spend a lot of money on nonsense. Number three, there's really no way to really manipulate gravity as far as science is concerned at this point. Maybe someday you basically have to warp space-time. The only thing you could do to warp space-time is with either high concentrations of energy or mass itself. If you move something the size of a planet a couple of miles above you, you'll weigh less. Go try and do that and survive. So right now, anti-gravity is just something that people read in science fiction and the voices in their head tell them stories about things like that. But otherwise, it's all meaningless.
The next subject is why light poles float on boats only, not flush with the ground. So, if you look at those poles that we have lights on the sidewalk, on the streets or the highways, you see something strange, because before there was a piece of concrete and there was a plate the pole was welded to, and the screw was screwed to the piece of concrete, and right now it looks like they are floating, so they are in the air. Of course the screws are holding it, but there is a space between the concrete and the pole. Maybe Dr. Roy would be able to, because I sent him the pictures. So the question is, why do they do that? Why do they mount any longer those poles to the concrete foundation? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
KC2GS, yeah, it's a leveling device. It's an easy way to adjust the level. So they put it in there, they put a leveler on it, they adjust the four screws, and so you don't have to plant it on the ground level. You can level it after you've done the base. Also, I think theoretically they think that there's a little bit improvement with the corrosion, that it, since it leaves a space rather than a tight a loose space for anything to kind of come and go, less likely for it to kind of get stuck between the metal plate and the cement, and so it lessens the corrosion. But I think it's primarily to just a means to level all these things after the stands are preset.
Yes, actually we could say that if you have something that is fastened to the foundation and for some reason the foundation is now crooked, now you need a heavy crane and so many people and so much of the expenses, and if you have it floating, then you can always re-level it. So leveling stability prevents corrosion and grounding. I would say that would be the points for it. But,
okay, you basically just rephrased what I said, but yeah.
And the last topic for the discussion is something that I would like Paul to take a stand on. Space debris weighing over 1,000 pounds crashes into Kenya village. Now we have a situation that the human space debris were fall on the Earth as a part of space, the Dragon capsule landing on Australian Sheep Farm in 2022. Then we had the NASA facing a lawsuit in 2024 from family in Florida that a piece of the debris hit their house. Then we have a China that is criticized by NASA for allowing a gigantic Long March rocket to fall back to Earth and whatsoever. And then we have this revelation that is 4 days ago. So imagine that you have a gear that is about 6 feet across deep, and it's 1,100 pounds, and falls on your head. So actually, it happened that nobody was killed. It falls on the ground, and now Kenyans think how to sue. So they're trying to sue somebody. We don't know who. They're trying. So Kenya Space Agency. It's 8 feet diameter, right? That was Mikuku Village in Makueni County. Okay, that was December 30th at 3 p.m. local time. Maybe Paul, would you like to take a stand on it?
I saw that. You know, you sent that to me. And yeah, they said that 8 foot diameter ring is probably one of the connecting pieces between two of the stages, but none of it's confirmed, so I really can't comment on that. But they did say it was heavy, couple thousand pound thing that came down, and this is going on, for decades, and we can't criticize anybody because look at Skylab. We had Skylab up there. You had three different crews that went up to visit it, and they had long-term plans. NASA wanted to that thing go. They thought the shuttle was going to be by then, and they were going to be able to dock with the shuttle. That never happened. They all ran out of money. A lot of funds were not there to do the different things they wanted to do. So that thing came down in near Australia. Some pieces actually hit the land. I think a lot of it went into the Indian Ocean. So, things are falling out of the sky all the time. You have China. For decades, I guess, they would launch, they had launch complexes inland. The reason everything was inland because they wanted to hide it from other governments. They would possibly launch, ICBMs in the middle of China. So when they started launching rockets for the space program, they didn't have any good launch facilities near the coast. Let me drop it. So what they would do is the rocket would launch, and the first stage, or the sometimes the boosters attached to them would come down and land in or near villages, you know, of the Chinese people. And I don't know if it killed anybody, but, you know, I saw debris and there's pictures of this. This used to happen all the time. So they got criticized for that. That's probably what NASA was talking about, criticizing China. You know, now China, you know, time has gone by. Now they have a couple of ways of launching vehicles where that doesn't happen. They built the Wang Chang launch complex right on the, what is it, the China Sea there. And they've been launching from there on a regular basis now. Also, they have a ship that goes out to sea, and they launch a rocket from there every now and then. You know, they can go anywhere with that ship. So, you know, I mean, there's improvements being made. There's also, they try to get agreements between all these countries to try to make sure that if you launch something, and it's going to be a dead piece of hardware up there, make sure before that gets launched, it has a little thruster on board to slow it down, so eventually they're able to deorbit it, and preferably over, you know, over water somewhere. Most things are designed to burn up over the South Pacific, and that's really the graveyard. That's about what I know. You know, always look up. You never know if it's coming down back to US.
So it looks like into HCN, we don't know when we're going to have a piece of the cosmic debris falling out on our head. And if you don't mind to comment on the approximate probability, I mean, probability is approximate, the probability of our spacecraft flying to the International Space Station or anywhere that would collide with the pieces of debris in the space. So a few words about the danger for people on Earth and people for the vehicles that we try to put in space. Back to you.
Well, chances are still low. You know, the Earth is, you know, a heck of a lot more water than there is solid ground. So chances of anything hitting the Earth is what I think that makes it like 3-1. You know, in favor of not getting hit. So, you know, you have that. And then, like I said, there's advances being done with all these satellites that are being sent up. For instance, SpaceX sends all those Starlink satellites up there. Each one has a HAL type of ion thruster on board where they can deorbit if the thing is not malfunctioning. They turn that thruster on, and eventually, you know, they can control the location where that thing comes down. And they've done that quite a few times. But, you know, accidents will happen, that's for sure. You know, I think when cars were invented, you know, they said that one time there was only two cars in Ohio or something, the way the story goes, and sure enough, they crashed into one another. So, you know, things are definitely going to happen, and, you know, it's definitely an odds game. You know, you're not going to make it 100%, but they, you know, they're doing better, and hopefully they do better in the future. Back to you.
Okay, thank you very much for that explanation. Back to Net Control, Dr. Roy. And thank you for giving me a chance to talk about the subject listed in my email, Dr. Roy, and to XCN.
AC2GS, well, thank you, Wes, as always, for your continued. continued participation. I feel bad for the people that didn't get a chance, Brian and David and Hank. Hopefully you come back next Sunday a little bit earlier, put you higher up on the list if you come back early, and you won't have this problem. So, again, caveat emptor. You got to kind of remember when the TechNet starts, because we can't just kind of leave spaces for people because we don't know who's going to be there and when they're going to be available and what have you. So anyway, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. It was a stimulating conversation. I learned some things. I hope you learned some things, and I hope you'll join me next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But now it is definitely time for Fall WS2N and the SpaceNet Report.
Yeah, thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And, one particular launch I'm looking forward to is the New Glenn, they call it the NG-1, or New Glenn 1, first launch of a heavy launch vehicle by Jeff Bezos with the Blue Origin company. You know, he's been launching suborbital flights quite a bit with the New Shepard over the last quite a few years. He launched himself into suborbital space. He launched a guy from Star Trek. The daughter of Shepard, Alan Shepard. She's older now. Alan Shepard was the first guy to, first American to do a suborbital flight. And sure enough, his daughter got a chance to do it as well on one of the new Shepard rockets. And that rocket uses a single liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They call it a BE-3 engine. And produces, 130,000 pounds of thrust. It's able to do these 15-16 minute flights. They get into space, they qualify as astronauts, and they come back down. But he's perfected the booster coming back, and they're able to reuse that. Brings it down on the dime now. Let me drop it. His next step was to have an orbital vehicle. And the suborbital is called the New Shepard, named after Alan Shepard. And the orbital vehicle is called New Glenn, named after John Glenn, first American to orbit the Earth. So now this thing is being built for many, many years by Blue Origin. And I thought it was going to finally launch in October. It still wasn't ready. The first launch, they were going to put the two Escapade satellites on board, and they were going to launch them to Mars on the very first launch of a brand new vehicle. But they weren't ready, so that got delayed. But they are ready now, and they can't put those satellites on board right now. They're going to go up in the springtime on the same rocket. Hopefully this thing is off the ground. And they're using a mass simulator, heavy weight, probably steel and concrete, a cylinder that gets put on board the second stage. And there's also some kind of a satellite. They're not going to separate it from the second stage, but they're going to test this gadget that they plan on using in the future for some of these mass amounts of satellites that they plan on launching at the same time. They call it the Blue Ring, I think it is. But anyway, this vehicle stands tall, 320 feet long. That means if you lay it down on a football field, it's going to go into the end zone. 23 feet in diameter, much bigger in diameter than the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 is 12 feet. It's also much taller at 320 feet. Definitely a heavy lift vehicle. Hopefully it will launch, get into orbit, and the first stage is planned to come back down and land on a drone ship. He's got a drone ship that's bigger than the drone ships that SpaceX uses. And if that's successful on the first flight, I mean, it's going to really be something. SpaceX doesn't think that way. They launch one after the other. Okay, didn't work, crashed, who cares? It landed in the water, who cares? We'll just improve on the next flight. Jeff Bezos don't think like that. Well, he thinks more or less like, you know, like NASA always did. You know, let's test everything out first, step by step. Make sure everything is 100% before we launch it into the air. So personally, I think it's going to make it. I got my fingers crossed. It was supposed to, again, launch. Actually, it would have launched like 1 o'clock in the morning coming up now. It was between 1 and 4, but which officially would have been on Monday morning. But it is delayed another 2 days on Wednesday morning at 1 o'clock in the morning. So they plan on launching it. But the window is from 1 to 4, I guess. So we'll see. It's kind of late to gamble and stay up and wait for this thing to launch. So, of course, we'll watch it on replays if it's successful. I'll report on that next week. Hopefully it gets off the ground and all goes well. If it does, this rocket is planned on the first stage. They plan on reusing 25 different times minimum. They have a large manifest plan for this year. So if it's successful, I expect to see quite a few launches of New Glenn. If not, well, there'll be delays, like always. I mean, ideally, Jeff Bezos wanted to get New Glenn off the ground in 2020, so he's already 5 years behind schedule. And they all are, you know, they have all these new rocket companies. SpaceX was the same, and still is the same, with their new vehicle, the Starship. So, yeah, the first stage consists of 7 BE-4 engines. Like I mentioned, the other one, for New Glenn, the suborbital flight, has the liquid hydrogen BE-3 engine. Well, this is what they call the BE-4 engine, but it's not liquid hydrogen as a fuel. It's liquid methane, liquid oxygen. Actually, in reality, it's LNG, liquid natural gas, which is a slight difference than methane. They claim they're going to get better performance out of this than you know, pure methane one. And there's less filtering involved, and there's less it's easier to reuse one of these things if it's got liquid LNG to it. So we'll see. So each engine produces 550,000 pounds of thrust. You have seven engines, so it's almost 4 million pounds of thrust. Compare that to the 1.7 million pounds of thrust that SpaceX is getting out of their Falcon 9 rocket. And, you know, you throw in reusability, and this thing's going to be able to put much more mass up during a year than a Falcon 9 could, if it's truly reusable. So there's competition going on, and we'll see how it works out. The first stage will separate from the second stage, push the second stage into orbit. The second stage has 2 BE-3 engines, like I mentioned, the BE-3 engine for the New Shepard. Well, instead of one of those engines producing 120 30,000 pounds of thrust. Now you have two engines on board the second stage. So this thing's really going to go. We'll see. And the reason they chose hydrogen is because eventually when they start launching to the moon, hydrogen is, you know, over time, they'll be able to get hydrogen out of the frozen water that's in the craters of the moon. You know, you separate the ice, create, melt everything down, now you have water, separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, now you have fuel, hydrogen, and also oxygen, not only to use for rockets, but of course you can now breathe with the oxygen. So anyway, that's one of the reasons for choosing hydrogen. I don't think it's the main reason. I think it's just a good way to launch. Problem is boil off with liquid hydrogen. You know, and they claim they have a way to permanently seal the liquid hydrogen, but they don't have that problem. I haven't figured out how they do that yet, but they claim they do, and otherwise they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. So I'm going to assume that they have that figured out. So there's another engine that they're also working on. Because once they get this new Glenn operating properly, they'll be sending a lunar lander to the moon. And that's called Blue Moon. And Blue Moon will be a lander which will be able to bring a crew of four down to the moon. And that will be liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen as well. And that's called a BE-7 engine. I've seen that thing's already been in a test van. They know it works. But now it's just time to develop that lander. Similar to that lander will be a cargo lander, also using that same BE-7 engine. And that will actually come first. They need to be able to land cargo and stuff to the moon on a regular basis. So that should be good. So you have basically two lunar landers being built by Blue Origin. One's going to be a cargo vehicle and another one to land a crew. And by the way, the landing of the crew is planned for right now anyway, 2030. So we got a ways to wait to see that come to fruition. Any comments? Anybody want to make any comments for the net? This is WS2N for the Space Night Report.
WB2BXO.
Good evening, Frank. Good to hear from you again. Over to you.
Maybe you just haven't gotten to it yet. I think supposedly there's supposed to be another Starship test this week, right?
Yeah, QSL. We'll see this thing go up on, I believe it's 10th. That's the date I heard. Well, it's a couple days from that, Starship number 7. They made some changes. Did you hear changes, Frank?
Yeah, you broke up. You seem to be clipping out of the past band. What date did you hear?
Okay. I wonder if I'm breaking up into the repeater. Or is it the echo link? I was wondering if you've heard of the changes. They've made some changes for number 7. And before you pick it up, Frank, Roy, am I breaking up at all? Okay,
a little bit, but
anyway, not breaking up any longer. I heard a little scratchy noise on my rig. When I'm keying down, I shouldn't hear that. Anyway, over to you, Frank.
Yeah, you doubled with Roy. I think Roy said there was a little breakup on his end, so it may be on the RF side. The date I think I heard was January 11th, would that be later this week? I guess so. And yeah, supposedly they're using a bigger, a larger Starship, and I think I saw on Marcus House, who I know you think is a show for the SpaceX, which is possible, said supposedly they're testing putting some dummy satellites aboard in their satellite pen dispenser to test that. And I believe they also may have larger Raptor 3 engines. And there's supposedly a heck of a lot of other changes that they don't know about. That's what I recall hearing that.
Yep, I got something similar. One of the engines, you know, the 33 engines that light up on the first stage, one of them is going to be a reused one from light number five. Light number five is the one that they caught with those big arms, launch tower. When they came back, so for some reason they're just testing out one of the engines officially say that they're reusing one of the Raptor engines. And they changed the flaps in the front. They moved them further to the front. They feel by doing that they're going to have less heating. If you watch some of the other videos, when it comes back through the atmosphere around India, the suborbital flights for now, they're really testing the ability for this thing to come through the atmosphere. There's a lot of burn up around the flaps where it connects to the Starship. So they think by moving it forward, they're going to have better control. They upgraded the linkage system for the flaps. It's supposed to be stronger. They've done some more work on the tiles. They put some kind of protective coating underneath in case the tiles do wear off. They'll have like a plan B, you know. Heard that. We'll see. Trajectory is the same. It's going to be suborbital this way. There's no way in the world it's going to wind up in orbit. They're still worried about that. They have tried in the past successfully to relight the engine. I think they did that on the last flight, on 6. But on 7, they're going to do it again. They're going to relight, you know, they need to prove that they can relight these engines. There's 7 engines on the second stage. They're all Raptor engines. 33 on the first stage, 7 on the, correction, 6 on the second stage. They have 3 regular Raptor engines, and they have 3 more Raptor engines, but they're designed for operating in a vacuum. They have these big nozzles on it, so we sell it's a vacuum rated engine that has these gigantic nozzles on it. So that's one of the things that they plan on doing. You mentioned there's bigger tanks and all, bigger, more fuel. I read 25% more fuel capability. I'm not sure how they did that. I don't think they made the whole Starship longer or boost the water. So they must have did something with the tanks, stretch the tanks, maybe the tanks so that it takes up more room vertically. There's an extra room. They're going to get more out of it. I haven't figured that out yet, but they're supposed to have 25% more fuel. So we'll see. Yeah, so you got a couple, two big launches this week. You got one, actually Wednesday morning, as far as I'm concerned, it's really tomorrow night, but 1 o'clock in the morning tomorrow night. But, yeah, officially 1 o'clock on Wednesday. And that will be followed 2 days later by, I read the test, but you're saying the 11th. So 3 days later for Starship. Should be great. Great week. See what happens to you. Any other comments, Frank?
Yeah, well, you know, in space flight, those launch dates are always kind of elastic anyway. So it could be the 10th, it could be the 11th, it could be the 12th. You know, it depends on, of course, where they can get their TFRs and all those other stuff, excuse me, all the other federal and ICAO approvals they need to do that. Anyway, okay, let's let you go on there. Well, hopefully we have a really interesting Flight 67 to talk about next week, and if that works, supposedly Flight 8 is going to be the money shot. They try to use the thing to put some Starlink satellites in orbit. And once they can do that, they can start making money with the thing. WB2BX, so have a good evening.
Okay, thanks, Frank. And hopefully they do what you said. See if they could launch, well, they're not going to launch satellites, they're going to launch something, maybe like mass simulators or something. To see if this, if that system works. So if they have satellites that they're going to be launching, I guess it's cool, version 3, are going to be much heavier. You know, there's probably 2,000 pound things, or maybe, I don't know what the weight is, but the weight is supposed to be more than the previous ones. So that should be interesting. We'll see how the both big rocket companies do. Blue Origin first, and then followed by SpaceX. I just want to mention one thing that NASA made a point of. This has to do with President Carter passing away. Bill Nelson, NASA administrator, made the statement that, you know, his voice is on the golden records, you know, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, both have those golden records on it, you know, with all the sounds of all the animals and all the different nations, different languages saying hello and all that, which we pretty much all know exists. And the idea is to send these spacecraft, you know, they're right now, they're well beyond the heliosphere of star system. And maybe, you know, I think it's 40,000 years from now, it's going to approach another star or something. Anyway, it's never going to hit a star, it's never going to hit a planet, but it'll wind up in orbit. In a galactic orbit, so going around the galaxy every quarter of a billion years. And if somebody actually comes across this in the eons of time, because this, you know, they say this golden record will survive the eons of time, you'll have all the different information that Earth existed at one time with people. Anyway, Carter had his voice on there, and what he said was if one such civilization intercepts Voyager and can understand these recorded contents, here is our message. This is a present from a small distant world, a token of our sound, our science, our image, our images, our music, our thoughts, and our feelings. We are attempting to survive our time so we may live into yours. We hope someday, having solved the problems we face, to join a community of galactic civilizations. This record represents our hope and our determination and our goodwill in a vast and awesome universe. So I thought that was pretty cool. So Carter gets to his voice anyway, gets to live on. Any comments? WS1.
Can you 2AJU or Paul? This is Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie. And how are you doing? And any comments?
Yes, I'm doing fine. As far as Voyager, somehow I cannot believe that this craft hasn't been visited or been monitored.
Yeah, but it's only outside of our solar system, you know. From here to Pluto, give you an idea, we're here to Neptune, is roughly 39 AU, astronomical units. Every astronomical unit is roughly 93 million miles. So, in other words, they measure the distance from the sun to the Earth, and it's 93 million miles. They call that 1 AU. Pluto is out there around 39, 40 AU. So, 40 times the distance between the sun and the Earth. That's where the Yato planet is. Give you an idea, it takes, 8 minutes for a radio signal or light to go from the sun to the Earth. So 40 times that, that's how long it takes to get a radio signal from here to the outer planet. Well, Voyager 1 is around 160 AU now. So that's four times that distance. And that's where Voyager 1 is. Voyager 2 is a little closer in, but, you know, they're both on their way, you know, out to nowhere. The nearest star system that one of them will come near would be Sirius, and I think that's something like 40,000 years from now, some such number. You could look up that on the internet. It's ridiculously long. Yeah, if you go back 40,000 years, I think that's getting back to the days, you know, when we lived in a cave. Anyway, back to you, Charlie. No chance of any civilization coming across that anytime soon. It's going to be a long time just to even get near to near one star. Back to you.
About this new Glenn rocket. I mean, this thing, why did they make it so wide? Why couldn't they make it a little taller?
Yeah, they really wanted width. The width of this thing is 23 feet in diameter. Much bigger than what they have on the Falcon 9. And the idea is they're going to eventually put a lunar lander on top of it called Blue Moon, and then something similar to it will be a cargo vehicle, like I mentioned before. So Blue Moon will be a lander, which will be able to take four people down to the surface of the moon, and they have it figured where you can live for a month down there, and then launch back up, and that be also be reusable. So to make a spaceship that big to go to back and forth to the moon, you need to encapsulate it on Earth before you launch it there. And it would have to be very wide, very big. Even with the 23 feet diameter lander, it's going to have legs on it, and that's going to open up. If you remember the LEM that landed, that was tight, you know, but the legs really opened up wide. From end to end on the legs, it was 31 feet, you know, but the body wasn't, you know, 31 feet. But in this case, the body's going to be 23 feet, and of course, the legs will be a little bit more than that. So you need room, a lot of room. It's going to be tall. If you were to stand inside, it would be like looking up at the top of it. It's going to be 7 feet long. So it would, you know, be like standing inside of a six-story building, you know. Back to you, Charlie.
Now, are they going to leave this on the moon, or are they bringing it back?
Yeah, the crew vehicle will be, like I said, be able to land four people. So that will never return to Earth. The idea is put it into this capsule, into the fairing. Alright, you launch it to the moon. And when it gets out there, it's going to go into a halo orbit around the moon. That means it will be able to dock with the space station that's not there yet. The space station is called Gateway. So you'll have this lunar lander dock with the space station and stay there really permanently until a crew gets launched from Earth. You know, and the plan is to launch on the SLS system that NASA's building. And on top of that SLS rocket, you'll have Orion. Orion will eventually, you will go to the moon with the crew of four, and it will dock with the space station, the Gateway space station. So they'll be able to get out and prepare for a landing. After they do that, they'll get into this Blue Moon lander that's now docked to the International Gateway Space Station. Get in, and then deorbit, go down and land on the moon with their liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen BE-7 engine that they've already successfully tested the engine. They'll land, spend days or weeks or up to a month capability using the this lander as a home. When they're finished exploring, they get back in. They relaunch BE-7 engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket ignites, takes off, and docks with Gateway Space Station. They get out, hang out in the space station for a while, and then eventually get back. Now they're going to leave that vehicle attached, and eventually they'll get out and get into Orion, and Orion flies all the way back and lands in the Pacific Ocean, picked up by the Navy, and all is well. That's how you get the crew back. Now, here's your question. It's attached to this Gateway Space Station. Now it's out of fuel. What are you going to do? Lockheed Martin is building a transit vehicle, completely separate from all of these other vehicles. Won't land on the moon or won't do anything like that, but it will carry fuel, liquid hydrogen, probably liquid oxygen. It will launch from Earth on either a Starship or most likely a Blue Origin New Glenn rocket, like they're going to launch a couple days. And this transit vehicle built by Lockheed will dock with the space station and will dock with, will somehow be able to hook up to this lunar lander, the Blue Moon lander, refuel it, and now it we'll be able to sit there waiting for another crew to come out maybe a year from now, you know, roughly every year. They plan on having another crew go out to the Gateway Space Station and land on it. That's the plan. Let's see what happens. Back to you, Charles. WS2N.
Is there any way of making the fuel in space?
Well, that's Jeff Bezos' idea. Ultimate goal, as the years go on, is to take the frozen ice out of the craters, turn that into, you know, melt it down, to turn it into water, separate the hydrogen and oxygen, and now you have your hydrogen. Because this Blue Moon lander works on hydrogen, they'll be able to use that, and the oxygen, they'll be able to use that. I mean, that's the theory. Many, many years from now, but that's one of the goals, is yet to eventually be able to fuel a rocket, you know, instead of from Earth, you know, from the Moon, or from, you know, from Mars. Different ways of doing it. Back to you, Charlie.
That's a good idea.
That time complete.
I never heard that before. That time complete. What are they giving us a warning now? A 1 minute warning? anyway, so we'll look forward to next week to see if we can report on any successes. Hopefully we don't report on any failures. There's no people going up in any of these things at the moment, so that's okay. But we'll see. We'll see what the new administration brings to. See if they're going to, you know, add or subtract anything from the space program. We'll follow it as always. Any other comments before I turn it over to Dr. Roy?
Well, I'll speak to you in 2 weeks. Next Sunday, I'm going to be in Florida, and hopefully I can watch it live.
Really? Yeah. Well, there would have to be a delay for next Sunday. But we'll see. That other one, that Starship that's going up from Texas. You're not going to Texas. That's the Starship one. But yeah, Florida. Yeah, I mean, if there's a delay and New Glenn makes it to next week, you'd be able to see it. But if not, they have these SpaceX launches all the time. You know, every 3 or 4 days, he's launching another group of Starlink satellites. So maybe you'll get a chance to see one of the Falcon 9s go up. Hopefully, John. Anyway, thanks for checking in and asking questions. As always, you too, Frank. For now, let me just turn it back over to Roy, and we'll be back next week. And actually, we'll be back tomorrow night for the ClubNet at 8:30, followed by Swap and Shop, if anybody has anything to buy or sell, and then followed by Newsline. There's always an amateur radio space-related topic with Newsline. They always find something. Roy, over to you. AT2GS, WS2N. Back to you.
Our revels now are done. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate the participation and activity tonight. It was like the good old days. We ran out of time. I don't like anyone feeling that they didn't get an opportunity, but it's a nice, it's a novel difference. So maybe we will go into 2025 with a little bit more activity than we did in 2024. So I just want to remind everyone, Dick, K2IW, may rest in peace. I used to end these technical nets with good advice, be kind to each other. I've added good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open, but not so open that your brains fall out. And I want to wish everyone a happy, healthy new year and have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. We'll talk down the line, and I hope you'll join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. So this is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.